Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. Today we continue our study of the wall of separation and our examination of how we got where we are as a client nation with regard to its decline, its degeneracy, and its ultimate demise. This minus, of course, what you do here. Before we begin, I have a couple of announcements to make. First of all, I would like to announce the newest member of Grace Doctrine Church. His name is Daniel Thomas Hunt. He was born Wednesday, August 7th at St. Luke's. The stats are as follows. He's 20 inches long, 7 pounds, 15 ounces. It's not known yet whether or not he is left-handed. I made an announcement, I believe it was last week, about the availability for our consideration as a church for a facility that is located on Big Bend Road. It is Lafayette Bible Baptist Church. And this is the directions on how to get there. The real estate agent that is handling this for somebody was contacted and arranged a time for 1 o'clock this afternoon for anyone in our church that wanted to drop by and take a look at the facility. It's very easy to get to. If you can find your way back to 141, you simply head south and drive all the way to Big Bend and take a right. And it's about 500 yards down that street on the right. It's before you get to Hannah. If you get to Hannah, you've overshot the field. But there are two churches you passed. There's Twin Oaks Presbyterian Church will be on your left. You can't miss that. And there's a very small church on your right that you could very easily miss, but it's there. And then the second church on your right is Lafayette Bible Baptist Church. The address is 929, and I believe it's out on the street. And that is the facility that we would tour this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Now, all of you are invited, even the Irish, but not the French. In our study, we're trying to amplify those things that have occurred in our nation's history that have led us to this moment of degeneracy and the need for a national revival. We have learned in our studies well enough that the survival of a client nation is contingent upon the inventory of ideas possessed by believers within that client nation. And within that client nation, there has to be an emerging pivot, a core of mature believers, and behind them, the advancing battalions of the double-column phalanx that are charging towards spiritual maturity. Now, what is the inventory of that group of individuals, and how big do they have to be? The answer to both questions is, we don't know. All we can do is do our duty, continue our advance, not be distracted by the exigencies around us, which seem to amplify daily, and therefore keep marching forward. Jesus Christ controls history on our behalf. Therefore, what we do here has more impact on the outcome of the issues that surround us than does anything a politician might even think of. In fact, it's hard for God to honor the actions of politicians today because politicians, as a group, are some of the most evil and despicable people on the face of this earth. And we're beginning to see this in our study. So don't depend on the politicians. They are the problem. They're the ones who got us here, except for this caveat. They reflect the mental attitude of the majority of the people in this country. What is the source of the mental attitude that causes these despicable people to be in authority? It is human viewpoint, human good, evil, and involvement in the dark side of morality. How did that come about? Because there was a loss of doctrinal thought within the Commonwealth. And the origin for that is found in the pulpits of Protestant churches in America. It all falls at the foot of pastors who have failed to do their duty to instruct their congregations about the thought patterns that are required for a client nation's pivot, and therefore the people have gang after glay, they have gone astray. And we're examining the decline of thought in our nation. And in the clanking chains insertion into our study, we're at paragraph 5, the wall of separation, shackles for the chains. We have noted the use of Jefferson's 1802 quote, the wall of separation, that he wrote in a letter to the Danbury Baptist of that year, and quoted by the 1947 court in the Everson case. This brought about the concept to our attention of judicial review. Judicial review is the power of the Supreme Court to invalidate the acts of government officials on the basis that it is disallowed by the Constitution. And therefore, the Supreme Court can say, this law that you have passed or this action that you have taken is unconstitutional. And they, under the principle of judicial review, can decree almost anything unconstitutional. And we noted the writings of Thomas L. Gipping. Does the First Amendment violate itself? There are a couple of principles we noted on Thursday evening that I must remind you of before we go forward. And this has to do with judicial review. Judicial review is a particularly powerful tool because it requires determining the meaning of the Constitution, as I've just noted. Therefore, judges, that's Supreme Court justices in our context, but judges as well, can derive the meaning of constitutional provisions from two basic sources. The first is external, that is outside the Constitution, and under this approach, the Constitution means what the judge wants it to mean, and often that is guided by prevailing political culture. This approach to judicial review is called judicial activism. The second source of constitutional meaning is internal, inside the Constitution. The judge determines the meaning already given to constitutional provisions by those who framed and ratified them. This, therefore, this form of judicial review is called judicial restraint. I then noted for you some rules for constitutional interpretation that are based on these two concepts that were developed by Gipping. Now, the opponents of judicial restraint argue that the Constitution should adapt, evolve, or grow with the times. Their error, however, lies in failing to distinguish between the dual judicial tasks of determining meaning and then applying that meaning. The Constitution itself does not change in its meaning. See, these fellows that developed this operated under absolutes, which is the way you study the Bible. The Bible presents absolutes, but a multiplicity of applications. Therefore, the Constitution, when you deal in absolutes, that's how you function. We have absolute concepts that we have before us here. What is the meaning of each of these provisions here? And then the case before us, the problem that is presented, has to be managed by the principles before us. These principles, therefore, may be applied to the problems that come before the court. And the Constitution, therefore, does not change its meaning. It must, however, adapt and evolve in its application to different facts, circumstances, and cases. Meaning, therefore, is what the Constitution's framers provided. Application of that meaning is what judges must do. An example given is courts can thus decide how the Fourth Amendment's prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures might apply to a wiretap or a drug test. These things, of course, never existed in the time of the framers. So application must be drawn from the Fourth Amendment's intent. What did it intend? This is one of the few places where right to privacy is specified in the Constitution. What you do inside your home is private. Therefore, the judges have to determine with regard to wiretaps whether that invades the privacy of the home. and they come up with their conclusions, and of course everybody decides to live with whatever they decide. Now the problem with Justice Black's majority opinion in the Everson case is that he determined the meaning of the Establishment Clause not from internal evidence in the Constitution or from external writings of the framers of the Constitution, but rather from the external writings of Jefferson, who was not a framer. And we noted a quote from John Eidsmoe's Christianity and the Constitution as we close Thursday, and here's that paragraph. The phrase separation of church and state appears nowhere in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. Jefferson made the statement in 1802, 13 years after Congress passed the First Amendment. Jefferson was not a delegate to the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, nor was he a member of Congress in 1789. That's when the provisions of the Bill of Rights were presented. Nor was he a member of any state legislature or ratifying convention. For Jefferson, that would have been Virginia. And he was not a member of the ratifying convention in Virginia, nor was he a member of the state legislature. At no time was he involved in any of these things relevant to the passage of the First Amendment. The question arises, where then was he? He was serving as U.S. minister to France during this entire time. He was not even in the country. Continuing now, point five. Consequently, Black's use of Jefferson's wall of separation to determine the meaning of the Establishment Clause is a true non sequitur. A non sequitur is a conclusion that does not follow from established evidence. In other words, he made it up. He picked it right out of thin air. He picked a phrase, actually a sentence fragment from Jefferson, 13 years post-ratification, and used that comment, a private comment by the president to a religious group, to construct a legal format that has actually driven this nation into decline. And the reason it occurred is the people of this country in 1947 did not have the moxie or the understanding to realize what had happened. But with the use of that phrase, he was able to take the entire Bill of Rights and apply it to the 14th Amendment, which meant it all applied to the states, including the Establishment Clause. So six, by establishing this false premise, Black's application of the Establishment Clause to the 14th Amendment caused this clause to then be applied to the states. Now, if you're not picking up on the legalities of this, I'm sorry, we've been through this over and over. It's very, very subtle. The legalese of all of these things gets to be quite boring. But the reason that you find the environment the way it is today is because very smart men who went to Harvard and other places up in that neck of the woods have wound up on the Supreme Court, and they're not dummies. They know what they're doing, although their decisions appear to be written by doofuses. They know what they're doing. They're very, very smart men. So you have to understand that. It's a rhetorical veil promoting while advancing, concealing while advancing a hidden agenda. And we'll get to the hidden agenda eventually. Seven. After determining that the Establishment Clause applied to the states, Black then applied his newly invented doctrine of separation to the states. That's a newly invented doctrine that borrowed from Thomas Jefferson, that was never intended to be a part of the Establishment Clause as we've established. Eight, Everson thus gave the Supreme Court the authority to rob the states of the very power they had retained for themselves in the 10th Amendment. Any power not delegated to the federal government was retained by the states or by the people. There's a difference there but between the states and the people that we'll note shortly, or at least at some due time in the future. The states involved the legislature, the government of the state. The people involved those who inhabited the state. The people had certain rights, and the state governments had certain rights. Those not delegated to the federal government remained with the states or with the people. 9. Everson applied the prohibition against establishing a religion to the states, a prohibition originally intended only to be imposed on the federal government, yet retained by the states. The states had a right to establish a religion. They didn't want to, but that's not the point. Virginia went to great lengths to make sure, under James Madison's insistence, that there would be no state religion in Virginia. Now, all states promoted Christianity. The idea was not to allow a single denomination to become the official denomination. And that is the idea of separation of church and state. No one denomination becomes a national or even a state denomination. But Christianity is considered to be the religion that is going to be promoted and upheld and benefited in all ways at all times. This is how the nation was founded. 10. Well, the result has been separationist creeds that have dominated Supreme Courts since Everson was decided in 1947. The separationist creed. Now, separationist refers here to the separation of church and state on a strict basis. 11. Separationist judges determined the meaning of the First Amendment's Establishment Clause not on internal evidence or the writings of the framers of the Constitution, but draw false conclusions from an external sentence fragment written by Thomas Jefferson. That little phrase of 8 words has been used to turn everything upside down. And by applying it to the 14th Amendment, and using it to allot the Establishment Clause to the 14th and thus to the states, gives the judiciary the power to become tyrannical toward religion. Further, 12. Separationist justice then apply these false conclusions in ways that go way beyond the Establishment Clause and what was originally intended to impose even on the federal government. The Establishment Clause imposed on the federal government the restriction of not isolating one denomination as the national religion. And this application from Everson, from its false conclusion, goes way beyond what was originally intended. So 13, the following quotes indicate the true intent of the First Amendment's restraint on the federal government. We can go back to Gipping, page 34, and find Joseph Story, who was the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, from 1811 to 1845. This is circa the time that we are noting here. He says, the real object of the amendment, referencing the first, was to exclude all rivalry among Christian sects. That's S-E-C-T-S. Have to be careful today. And to prevent any national ecclesiastical establishment, which should give to a hierarchy the exclusive patronage of the national government. So the Baptists can't run the show and get the money and all of the backing. Neither can the Methodists or the Presbyterians or the Church of Christ or the Jehovah's Witnesses. Thomas M. Cooley, he was a justice on the Missouri Supreme Court, Michigan Supreme Court, and professor of law at the University of Michigan from 1859 to 1898. Here's his take. By establishment of religion is meant the setting up or recognition of a state church, or at least the conferring upon one church of special favors and advantages which are denied to others. That's the gist of the First Amendment's Establishment Clause and its original intent. 14. Thus, when the Everson decision forged a shackle upon the states, to which has been added a long series of links, forming a clanking chain of judicial tyranny against Christianity, increasing prohibitions against community standards, and Fabian encroachments against general order in the Commonwealth. The Everson decision did this. It formed a shackle, and that shackle has been bound around several aspects of our culture. There has been one link that has been added to the shackle, judicial tyranny against Christianity. Another, increasing prohibitions against community standards. A third link, Fabian encroachments against the general order in the Commonwealth. This having to do primarily with certain rules and regulations regarding searches and seizures, regarding gaining evidence, testimony at trial, and therefore many criminals walk because of technicalities. 15. The links in this ever elongating clanking chain now comprise some of the most bizarre and dumbfounding applications of law ever perpetrated on a free people. Here are a few. What I'm going to read to you is an excerpt from a dissenting opinion in Wallace versus Jaffrey and a 1985 opinion written by then Justice William H. Rehnquist. And he is isolating most of his remarks here, if not all, on rulings that have come down under these rationales and have been applied to federal schools. And we're seeing great contradiction here because of confusion. He is giving, therefore, a comparative analysis. Rehnquist writes, "A state may lend to parochial school children geography textbooks that contain maps of the United States." Board of Education versus Allen, 1968. "But the state may not lend maps of the United States for use in geography class." Meek versus Pittenger, 1975. "A science book is permissible. A science kit is not." Wallman versus Waller, 1977. "A state may lend textbooks on American colonial history, but it may not lend a film on George Washington or a film projector to show it in history class. A state may lend classroom workbooks, but not lend workbooks in which the parochial school children write, thus rendering them unreusable." This is Meek versus Pittenger, 1975. "A state may pay for bus transportation to religious schools." Everson versus Board of Education, 1947, "but may not pay for bus transportation from the parochial school to the public zoo or natural history museum for a field trip." Wallman versus Waller, 1977. "A state may pay for diagnostic services conducted in the parochial school, but therapeutic services must be given in a different building. Speech and hearing services conducted by the state inside the sectarian school are forbidden." Meek versus Pittenger, 1975. "But the state may conduct speech and hearing diagnostic testing inside the sectarian school." Wallman versus Waller. "Exceptional parochial school students may receive counseling, but it must take place outside of the parochial school." Wallman versus Waller. Meek versus Pittenger. "Such as in a trailer parked down the street. A state may give cash to a parochial school to pay for the administration of state written tests and state ordered reporting services." Committee for Public Education and Religious Liberty versus Regan, 1980. "But it may not provide funds for teacher-prepared tests on secular subjects." Levitt versus Committee for Public Education, 1973. "Religious instruction may not be given in public school." McCollum versus Board of Education, 1948. "But the public school may release students during the day for religious classes elsewhere and may enforce attendance at those classes with its truancy laws. Zurich versus Clausen, 1952. Point 16. The Wallace versus Jaffrey decision was rendered in 1985. Mr. Rehnquist was an associate justice at the time, but the following year in September 1986, he became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and remains so today. 17. The comparisons just noted by then Justice Rehnquist and Wallace versus Jaffrey were intended by him to demonstrate the contradictory labyrinth created by the Supreme Court decisions based on the faulty premise that Jefferson's wall of separation. Rehnquist concludes with the following remark in his dissent in Wallace. He says, if a constitutional theory has no basis in the history of the amendment it seeks to interpret, is difficult to apply, and yields unprincipled results, I see little use in it. He says, this is a theory, the wall of separation. This theory has no basis in the history of the amendment it seeks to interpret. It's difficult to apply, as we've just noted, as he just noted, and yields unprincipled results. And therefore, he says, I see little use in it. The crucible of litigation has produced only consistent unpredictability, and today's effort is just a continuation of the Sisyphean task of trying to patch together the blurred, indistinct, and variable barrier. Patch it together. This is in Wallace versus Jaffrey. We have done much straining since 1947. That's Everson. But still we admit that we can only dimly perceive the Everson wall. Our perception has been clouded not by the Constitution, but by the mists of an unnecessary metaphor. Rehnquist, 1985. 18. Justice Rehnquist makes reference here to Jefferson's wall, and in his dissent in Wallace presents an excellent case for abandoning the troublesome metaphor in future Establishment Clause cases. That was 1985, 17 years ago. Following excerpts are lengthy, but are extremely instructive and carry tremendous credibility in view of the fact that Mr. Rehnquist is the current Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. I have provided for those who are interested the link to the Cornell University School of Law's website and the page that contains Rehnquist's dissenting opinion in Wallace versus Jaffrey. I now offer excerpts. Although they are lengthy, you will find them quite interesting if you can stay awake. But he is ripping these guys. But in 1985, don't ever forget that. It is impossible to build sound constitutional doctrine upon a mistaken understanding of constitutional history. But unfortunately, the Establishment Clause has been expressly freighted, that means burdened, with Jefferson's misleading metaphor for nearly 40 years. Thomas Jefferson was, of course, in France at the time the constitutional amendments known as the Bill of Rights were passed by Congress and ratified by the states. His letter to the Danbury Baptist Association was a short note of courtesy written 14 years after the amendments were passed by Congress. He would seem to any detached observer as a less than ideal source of contemporary history as to the meaning of the religion clauses of the First Amendment. Of all the people to reference, he would be the less ideal source. Jefferson's fellow Virginian, James Madison, with whom he was joined in the battle for the enactment of the Virginia Statute of Religious Liberty, that's 1786, prior to the development of the Bill of Rights. A lot of explanation goes on here, but it is important. Madison and Jefferson were involved in developing the Virginia Statute of Religious Liberty. This is 1786. They were vehement in their opposition to any permission for Virginia to establish a state religion. They were opposed to this and spoke out against it. And eventually that idea was passed in Virginia. States have a right to decide these things, pro or con. So Jefferson's fellow Virginian, James Madison, with whom he was joined in the battle for the enactment of the Virginia Statute of Religious Liberty, 1786, Madison did play as large a part as anyone in drafting of the Bill of Rights. See, Jefferson didn't, Madison did. He had two advantages over Jefferson in this regard. He was present in the United States, one advantage. And he was a leading member of the First Congress. But when we turn to the record of the proceedings of the First Congress leading up to the adoption of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, including Madison's significant contributions thereto, we see a far different picture of its purpose than the highly simplified wall of separation between church and state. During the debates in the 13 colonies over ratification of the Constitution, one of the arguments frequently used by opponents of ratification was that without a Bill of Rights guaranteeing individual liberty, the new general government carried with it a potential for tyranny. The typical response to this argument on the part of those who favored ratification was that the general government, established by the Constitution, had only delegated powers, and that these delegated powers were so limited that the government would have no occasion to violate individual liberties. The response satisfied some, but not others, and of the 11 colonies which ratified the Constitution by early 1789, 5 proposed one or another amendments guaranteeing individual liberty. 3 of them, New Hampshire, New York, and Virginia, included in one form or another a declaration of religious freedom. That's Jefferson and Madison, as you recall, in 1786. Rhode Island and North Carolina flatly refused to ratify the Constitution in the absence of amendments in the nature of a Bill of Rights. Virginia and North Carolina proposed identical guarantees of religious freedom. Here's a quote. All men have an equal, natural, and unalienable right the free exercise of religion, according to the dictates of conscience, and no particular religious sect or society ought to be favored or established by law in preference to others. End quote. That comes from Virginia and North Carolina. They have a right to do this. On the basis of the record of these proceedings in the House of Representatives, James Madison was undoubtedly the most important architect among the members of the House of the amendments which became the Bill of Rights. But it was James Madison speaking as an advocate of sensible legislative compromise, not as an advocate of incorporating the Virginia Statute of Religious Liberty into the United States Constitution. These are men of integrity. Let me explain. In 1786, Madison and Jefferson are seeking to make sure that there is not a state religion in Virginia, and they speak out against the establishment of religion as a state church, a certain denomination. But as time passes, the Constitution is developed the very next year in Philadelphia. The Constitution is signed in 1787. It is then passed around to the state constitutional conventions to ratify or not ratify. 9 were needed for ratification out of the 13. Now, many of the states many of them said, we're not ratifying without a Bill of Rights. We want certain rights enumerated in this Constitution, and they need to be attached as amendments to it. And the decision was, is that if you ratify, we promise there will be amendments to meet whatever your concerns happen to be. They met, the House met, as is described here, and James Madison became an advocate of sensible legislative compromise. Why? Because Madison is no longer functioning in Virginia, seeking to influence his fellow Virginians regarding the issue of establishing a state church. He is in the House of Representatives. He is there dealing with the ratification of the Constitution and the attached amendments. And he gave his word, I am involved in this. If you will ratify, I promise amendments. Personally, he was opposed to the amendments. He felt there were no need for them. The federal government has limitations placed upon it by the Constitution, and they can't go outside of those boundaries, so what are you worried about? And everybody said, well, we're not ratifying unless we get amendments. And he said, okay. And he stood up on the House floor, and he was a leading proponent for these amendments, and actually he and several other fellows are the ones who crafted the verbiage of the amendments, including the first. So, when you look at what Jefferson and Madison did in Virginia and seek to extract from that rationales for applying the Establishment Clause to the states, you're not understanding what's going on and you don't understand the integrity of the men of that day. What he believed was right for Virginia could not be applied to the states as far as the Constitution was concerned. And so he stood up for a clause that said that you can't establish a state religion, meaning a national religion. And he personally did not believe that even the Bill of Rights were necessary. So to continue, during the ratification debate in the Virginia Convention, Madison had actually opposed the idea of any Bill of Rights. His sponsorship of the amendments in the House of Representatives was obviously not that of a zealous believer in the necessity of the religion clauses, but of one who felt it might do some good, could do no harm, and would satisfy those who had ratified the Constitution on the condition that Congress propose a Bill of Rights. He was doing his duty and fulfilling his promise. His original language, nor shall any national religion be established, obviously does not conform to the wall of separation between church and state idea which latter-day commentators have ascribed to him. His original verbiage for the First Amendment's first religion clause, nor shall any national religion be established. And the word national is very important there. That was his verbiage. His explanation on the floor of the meaning of his language, that Congress should not establish a religion and enforce the legal observation of it by law, is of the same ilk. When he replied to Huntington in the debate over the proposal, which came from the Select Committee of the House, he urged that the language, no religion shall be established by law, should be amended by inserting the word national in front of the word religion. No national religion shall be established by law. It seems indisputable from these glimpses of Madison's thinking, as reflected by actions on the floor of the House in 1789, that he saw the amendment as designed to prohibit the establishment of a national religion and perhaps to prevent discrimination among some sects. He did not see it as requiring neutrality on the part of the government between religion and irreligion. That's what we have now, neutrality between religion and irreligion. The government takes no position on either, where originally they were to have open discussion, debate, conversation, even street preaching, anywhere you wanted to go, in the promotion of Christianity. But no single denomination would be allowed to be a national religion. And so he did not see it as requiring neutrality on the part of the government between religion and irreligion. Thus, the court's opinion in Everson, while correct in bracketing Madison and Jefferson together in their exertions in their home state, leading to the enactment of the Virginia Statute of Religious Liberty in 1786, is totally incorrect in suggesting that Madison carried these views onto the floor of the United States House of Representatives when he proposed the language which would ultimately become the Bill of Rights. Now, we have a couple more pages of Rehnquist here, and we will continue at this point when we come back, and we'll continue to note some of his analysis of the problems that have emerged from Everson and had been carried on right down to that day, 1985. Our prayer meetings will meet in their usual places, and we'll meet back here at approximately 10 till the hour.